Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
Anything that I do is not meant to finger point or lay blame, but I have to. I have an obligation to tell the community when I think the system isn't working. And that's what I think. I think the system isn't working.
There has been a lot of finger pointing in the wake of the deadly gun violence plaguing the city for the past several months. You've heard comments from Mayor Bowser just this week about the D.C. courts process and the impact on violence in the city. And tonight we will hear what the judges have to say about that. My guests are Anna Blackburn Rigsby, Chief Judge of the D.C. Court of Appeals, and Juliet McKenna, Associate Judge of D.C. Superior Court. We also would like to hear from you, our listeners. What do you think about the court system in the District of Columbia? What impact, if any, do you believe the courts have on D.C.'s deadly violence? I want to hear from you. Also, the judges will answer any questions that you may have about the court system. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H. Fisher, WHUR, or you're welcome to find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Your Honors, thank you so much for joining the program and talking to us tonight.
Thank you. And just by the way, this is Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring of the Superior Court, not Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. I apologize for that. I'll make sure that I correct that. Your people reached out to me to discuss this. I'll start with you, Judge Herring. Why do you think it was necessary to have that conversation?
Well, I think it's important for the public to know that the courts are open and have been open since the start of the pandemic. Of course, we, like every other entity or organization or agency, were completely caught off guard by the pandemic, there being no vaccine at the beginning. And so the court really quickly transferred its business from an in-person business where we were seeing over 10,000 people in our courthouses, in our courthouse on a daily basis. At least 10,000 people were coming through our doors daily, to one where we were really operating virtual hearings mostly online, except we've always maintained some footprint in the building, even in those early times, early March 2020, and the criminal division arraignments, where people and presentments, once people are arrested, have always been ongoing from the start of the pandemic. We also have done sentencings and other hearings and done bench trials in some other matters and resolved cases. So I think it's important that the community not think that the court was in fact closed, because the court has not been closed. And it's also important for the judges not to feel deflated by having worked hard to transition from in-person proceedings to continue having our system operate and operate quite robustly. So I thought it was important to just make sure the public understands that the court is clear, that it has been open, and understand its critical role in the justice system.
Does it sound like the mayor understands that?
Well, I think the mayor, like all of us, are really under a lot of sort of pressure and wanting the city to get back up and running. We want the court to be fully operating in person, but we must put health and safety first. And I just want to be clear, this is not a position that I'm taking to take quarrel with the mayor on a personal level. The mayor has been quite helpful to the court. She ensured that the judges were able to get their vaccine so that we could get up and running pretty early on in the process, and so we're grateful to her for that. But the timing of when the city fully restarts and when you can sort of restart, if you will, jury trials, which are sort of the last thing to start in the justice process, just don't necessarily always coincide, although we have had trials going on, I think, as early as May. We had been planning for quite a while, even before we started trials, to bring jurors back to our building. But we wanted to make sure things are safe, and you can't just lick or flip even a switch and have everything turn on the way it was before the pandemic.
Judge McKenna.
Good evening.
Hi, how are you? I want you to listen to something that Chief Robert Conte said after the shooting on 14th Street. And I want you to react to it if you can, please.
We can take the political route and talk, you know, all of this fluffy stuff. But I'm going to give it to you straight where the issues are. And where the issues are, the ecosystem, the justice system that we have right now, it is not functioning the way that it should. The courts are not open. That is a fact. Barely open. So cases from last year, from 2020 that happened during COVID, of violent criminals that have not been disposed of, what do you think those individuals are? Anybody want to take a guess? They're in community. They're in community, and their cases have not been disposed of. We have to look at, are the things happening that needs to happen when we do place individuals under arrest? The guy for carrying the gun there, the guy for carrying the gun there. What happens with that case when it goes through the system? What's the outcome? What is the expected outcome? What does the community expect when a person gets caught with a firearm? What do we expect? Do we expect to see them in a neighborhood in 3 weeks? And if we do, are we saying that that's acceptable?
Your thoughts about that, Judge McKenna?
So I should first say that I have a great deal of respect both for Chief Conte and the work of the Metropolitan Police Department. And obviously, we share his concerns about gun violence in the city. Any homicide, any violent crime, particularly violent crime involving gun violence, is a tragedy for everyone in the District of Columbia. But the Superior Court, and in particular the Criminal Division, has remained open throughout the pandemic. We have been working closely with all of our criminal justice partners to include the Metropolitan Police Department, the Marshals Service, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's Office, as well as the Defense Bar and our pretrial and probation supervision agencies, not only to ensure public health, but also community safety. And so we have been open to fulfill those key functions and have been processing cases throughout the pandemic.
So what do you say to those people in the community who say that blood running in the street and deadly gun violence is also an issue of public safety and health?
Well, I think it is, and we would all agree. We live in this city as well. All of the judges on our court are required to live in D.C. In order to even be considered for a local bench. But there are obviously a combination of factors that result in violence and unrest, and a number of those factors relate to what's happening in communities. Some of it relates to poverty. Some of it relates to individuals who have a complete disregard for the lives of others or the law. Some of it relates, quite frankly, to whether people are properly supervised, whether they're properly parented. Some of it relates to kids getting involved in activities due to peer pressure. And so there are a lot of reasons for why there's violent crime. Cities are dealing with upticks in violent crime all across the nation at this time, but certainly the court is a partner of all the city agencies. We're a partner with the executive branch. We work with members of the city council and individuals representing law enforcement agencies or justice agencies, as mentioned, including the U.S. Attorney's Office. We do not make the laws in the District of Columbia. The city council determines what the law is, and our job is to interpret the statutes regarding detention and the laws regarding sentencing in a way that is set out or prescribed by law. We don't make the law, we follow it. We do have discretion, obviously, in some instances, but in many instances, there is a great deal of direction or prescription with respect to what we are to look at in terms of factors to consider before releasing people into the community. And there are definitions, really, about what is relevant to determining that someone is dangerous. And so we are bound to follow that law. It's not to say that we don't take chances with people. Of course we do. Otherwise, we would throw away the key and always lock everybody up every single time there was a serious event. But we look at the person's ties to the community, their prior history of involvement in the court system, the nature and circumstances of the offense for which they're before the court. And quite frankly, judges can't lock criminal defendants up who are before the court for arraignment or detention on the front end of the case when the case first comes into the system without there being a request from the prosecutor's office. And that is true whether you're talking about the U.S. Attorney's Office on the adult side or the Office of Attorney General on the juvenile side. So we can't sort of move that process forward without those prosecuting agencies doing their part. Now, the truth is, all of the agencies that I mentioned, the U.S. Attorney's Office, OAG, the court, pretrial services, and some others, we're doing our part. But, in fact, a lot is happening, as I said, in these neighborhoods. A lot is happening in the homes where some of these young people and other people live. And that really has resulted in those cases coming into our system. I don't think I would blame anyone for being the reason for why somebody decides to commit a senseless act, like shooting into a crowd without provocation or even with provocation. Some people, again, have no regard for the law, and we look at each individual case that comes into the system. We make a determination about what is appropriate on a case-by-case basis. And I should also tell you that the legislature determines what the policy is in terms of law, and if the law is such that the court is required to address motions presented to us to release people back into the community with factors that have been set out by the city council, we don't have discretion in doing that, and we have to follow the law. So you have the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch, and all of it's connected, and we provide checks and balances on each other. But our role in the system is to apply the law and at times exercise discretion, and we do a whole lot for the community through services also we provide at the court.
You just said a lot, and I do want to drill down a little bit with that, but we are talking about the D.C. court system as it relates to the wave of deadly violence in the city, specifically as it relates to gun violence and what impact, if any, the court system has on the rise in gun violence over the past several months. Lines are open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you have any comments, if you have any questions, give us a call. We are talking to Anita Josie Herring, who is the Chief Judge of the D.C. Superior Court, also Associate Judge Juliet McKenna of the D.C. Superior Court. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Outside of the politics, and I do want to make sure that people have an understanding, because as you know better than most, that most of the people who show up in your courtroom who are victims, who are family members of victims or family members of the accused, these people have not gone to law school. And they're, and in many cases, the family members and loved ones are, their interaction with the criminal justice system may be somewhat limited if they are standing in the audience, for lack of a technical term, in the gallery. How much discretion do you have, Chief Judge, in determining whether or not someone, for example, is offered bail? Today, for example, Mark Twan Hargraves, the 22-year-old who is accused of killing Nia Courtney, he is being held on no bail. Now, certainly he was released on bail in Prince George's County. Is that kind of case a result of a request by the prosecutor? And if the prosecutor, for example, offered bail, do you have the leeway to say no bail, or do you have to go by the recommendation of a prosecutor?
Well, let me just say I can't comment on a pending case. It would be a violation of the judicial code of conduct. But in a case, in a murder case, for example, if a defendant were arraigned or presented in the courts and the government did not ask whether it was the local prosecutor or the federal prosecutor for the court to hold the defendant, the court has no independent authority to do that. But where there is a request to detain a defendant, the defendant is entitled to have the court consider all of the evidence in determining whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime occurred. In addition to that, there are legal standards that have resulted from legislation that has been passed at the city council that requires the court to find in the case of a murder that
Your Honor, can you hold your point? I've got to take a really quick break, and I can let you finish your point. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we are also going to go to the phones. We are talking about the court system in the district and what impact, if any, it may have on the deadly violence going on in the city. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. Stretch in for John Mons. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 and our other platforms in just a bit. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking tonight with Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring of the D.C. Court of D.C. Superior Court, and also Associate Judge Juliet McKenna of the D.C. Superior Court. And tonight we are talking about what impact the D.C. court system may be having on D.C.'s deadly violence in the city. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Chief Judge, I was asking the question, how much leeway do you have, for example, in refusing bail to someone who has been accused of murder? Can you help me here? Because one of the problems, and I know you are, you know, are an esteemed jurist, but I really need you to help me keep it flat-footed and plain, because I don't want to lose people, and I'm lost. I'm a relatively well-educated guy, but I'm really trying to understand, And I think a lot of people in the community are trying to understand also, why are these people going back on the street, some of them, if they are accused of a horrific crime? Some of the crimes lesser so, some more so. And I really want people to have a full, plain-spoken understanding. If Joe Smith is accused of a horrific crime and he is able to post bail and he commits another crime, and I think that's one of the other things. I'm not talking about COVID. I'm not talking about backlog. I'm talking about what one of the things that the chief has been complaining about, one of the things that members of the community, of these communities that are under siege in the district, are complaining about, are concerned about. Why do those things happen?
Well, we follow the law, as I indicated, and assuming the prosecutor asks that a person who's arraigned or presented to the court, who has their first court appearance, essentially, be held, we have a hearing, a brief hearing. We review the Gersting, which we call, you know, which are essentially, if there's an arrest warrant, it would be that, to figure out if there's a basis for believing that the person was involved in the crime. And if we find that there is, then essentially the government has a pretty high burden based on the law in the District of Columbia. They have to establish that the person is a danger to the community, and that is essentially, the government has to show that by what we call a preponderance of the evidence, by some evidence, that the government is able to prove the person guilty at trial beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a pretty high standard on the front end of cases. And so if we can't find, based on the evidence that has been presented, that standard can be proved, it is our lawful obligation to not hold the person, certainly without bond. If we are dealing with a person that has prior convictions, if those convictions are, of course, assaultive or violent, that would weigh in favor of detaining the person, or if the person has a pending case and they appear before us on another violent crime, for example, the court could consider that in deciding whether to release them. But as I said, we follow the law, and the law is in the form of legislation passed by the city council. I should tell you that, you know, there has been lots of concern about over-incarceration throughout the nation, and I'm not taking a position on that because I can't as a judge. But when COVID hit, there was legislation passed by the city council, and quite frankly, there was legislation passed in many places, in many states around the country, to get prisoners out of harm's way because people were dying because they were contracting COVID. And so we did release a number of people as COVID was sort of raging and flourishing through the jails, to protect people who had underlying medical conditions that would have made them at higher risk of death or serious illness. And so that is where we were, as quite frankly, a nation in terms of criminal justice when COVID was flourishing throughout prisons and jails across the country. And there was no vaccine. There was no other way for our system to deal with this. And so the question was one of life and death. So we did release some individuals who may not ordinarily have been released under ordinary circumstances, or who were some individuals were released that were held pretrial before that. But again, this was a life and death sort of situation.
And Judge, excuse me. Yes, you're absolutely right, and I'm certainly well aware, and I want to make sure that we get not only Judge McKenna in, but our phone calls. But you do raise a point, and I don't know whether or not you have this information. Do you have any statistics that bear out whether or not, at least in the District of Columbia, whether or not those COVID releases, any of those individuals who were released based on these COVID concerns, whether or not those people committed any violent crimes?
Well, I think Judge McKenna can speak more about this, but the percentage is very low, and I don't know that the percentage of people that are on pre-trial release right now who are re-offending includes only COVID people, but there's a very small percentage of people who are getting who are committing new offenses who have been on release. Judge McKenna, can you just take it
Yes,
from
please,
here?
Judge McKenna.
Absolutely, if you don't mind if I jump in on that. I mean,
no,
first of all, I think it's important to put this issue in the proper context. I mean, it is a mischaracterization to suggest that the court is releasing violent offenders. We currently have over 700 individuals who are detained at the D.C. jail. The overwhelming majority, well over 600 of those individuals, are detained in violent felony cases. So to suggest that the court was releasing individuals charged with homicide or attempted murder or violent crimes, particularly violent crimes involving guns, is just simply not accurate. While the chief is certainly correct that the court was inundated with emergency bond review motions, compassionate release motions, pointing to the conditions at facilities across the country, while the court did grant some number of those motions, many of those motions were denied because the judges simply could not find that the defendants had overcome the initial finding that they posed a danger to the community and that there were simply no conditions or combination of conditions that would ensure the community's safety. So while it is correct that some people have been released, many people have remained detained since the outset of the pandemic, throughout the pandemic, and each and every day as they are arrested on violent crime. With respect to the question about individuals who are rearrested, who have been released from the court, we are very fortunate to have a wonderful pretrial services agency in the District of Columbia who are incredibly skilled and effective at their job. And of the 90% of individuals who the court may release without a financial bond, approximately 87 of those individuals remain arrest-free while awaiting trial. I think it's important to also emphasize that of those small portion of individuals who are rearrested, less than 2% of those individuals are alleged to have committed a violent crime. And notwithstanding the pandemic-related challenges that cities such as the district are facing across the country, pretrial has sustained a similar performance throughout the pandemic.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Anthony, calling from D.C., thank you for being patient. What's on your mind?
Yes, how you doing? Good afternoon. And as I'm listening...
Go right ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, please.
As I'm listening to the program, respect to both of the judges, they are speaking of knowledge of what they have, but it's very confusing to us who live in the city, and we see different. And, you know, there's, like the mayor said, everybody is pointing fingers right now. The mayor says she wasn't going to have the guys on bicycles anymore, the policemen on bicycles. When I ride through the city, that's all you see. They on bicycles, but they standing on corners. She said that she wasn't going to have them sitting in the cars on corners. Well, that's still happening. And you have that task force, that gun task force, that rides through the neighborhood. And I was a victim of it with my four sons last year, where they pull four or more people over in a car to see if they have guns. I work every day. My sons work.
Anthony, let me, forgive me, in defense of the mayor and the chief, they are not here to address your concerns in that regard. Can we are talking to the judges. Do you have something specifically as it relates to the courts that you want to try to address?
Well, the court systems, they do operate under what is their laws on what they have presented to give a person when they come in with a violent crime, and they have to work under their guidelines. But still, I think the judges should be trying to work with the community, and they should be trying to work with solving this issue, because we could talk about it all day. But what are we going to do to solve this issue? Because people are being out. Their numbers are not all accurate. I live in the city. I understand the city, and I know people. They are releasing some of these criminals. They are releasing people that have backgrounds of having weapons and felony charges. So their numbers are not squeaky clean. So it can sound like that. And what they're saying, they're supposed to say it. They're on the air. But I don't have to portray anything that wears, though I have to say something that makes it politically correct. I'm speaking the truth of the neighborhood I come out of. And some of the stuff the judges are saying is just not accurate.
Judge McKenna, your thoughts about what Anthony is sharing with us?
Well, you know, I think like Anthony, I share concerns about gun violence in the city. I'm also a resident of the District of Columbia, and I am deeply concerned, particularly by the events of the last several weeks. But, you know, we look at each case individually, and we make a determination based upon all of the information that's available to us at that time, taking into consideration, you know, all of the various factors, prior criminal history, the nature of the incident offense, prior track record on supervision, community ties, in following the law in the District of Columbia in determining whether there are no conditions of release that would assure the safety of the community and the safety of the victim. And as I said, many people have remained detained without bond in the District of Columbia awaiting their trial date.
Anthony, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate your time. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Judge McKenna, before we picked up the phone call from Anthony, and you were, you know, talking about, you know, some of the issues that that I mentioned, you know, before in reference to what the chief was saying. And you were saying that some of the things that the chief was saying just aren't true. From your perspective, and I'd also like to hear what Judge Herring has to say as well. What do you believe is a possible solution to addressing some of the issues of deadly violence in this community? And this is a question that I've been asking quite a bit with several guests for the past several weeks. So I'll start with you, Judge McKenna, and then Judge Herring as well.
So, I just want to be clear that I'm certainly not indicating that Chief Conte is not being truthful in his statement. I just want to put those statements in the proper context, which is that the court is holding a significant number of individuals who are charged with violent offenses. I think we do understand the role that the court plays in emphasizing to people that there will be consequences to their actions, and that if they have committed a serious crime and there are not conditions that would assure the safety of the community or the individual's return back to court, that they may be held without bond while they are awaiting their trial date. But obviously the issue of gun violence in the district and across our country is a persistent and intractable issue. And I am not going to claim sitting here today that I have the answers how to solve that problem. I think we are committed to continuing to work with all of our criminal justice partners to ensure the safety of the District of Columbia and to ensure that justice is done.
Well, I would not, you know, presume that you would have the answer, but perhaps you might have an answer, a thought, a something that you may have, you know, considered and, you know, discussing, because this is, as you said, you live in the city. Chief Judge Herring lives in the city. This is a concern for everyone, not just people who live east of the river. This is something that concerns, you know, everyone. And from and from, you know, an edified position of where you sit, this is not new. And so certainly, and you may not. And,
no, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. I mean, I do think what we as a city have to bring people to understand is that we shouldn't wait until gun violence impacts on a particular individual or a family. We are all impacted by it as a community. And those individuals who carry guns illegally in our city need to understand that they are putting not only themselves at risk, but their loved ones at risk and the community at large at risk. And I think if there is a greater understanding about the damage that gun violence is doing to our community as a whole, and preventing our children from being able to grow up in communities where they can be outside, they can play on playgrounds, they can freely walk to and from school without worrying about gun violence, that is a crime that's committed against the city at large. But I don't have the answers about how best to deliver that message across the city, and more importantly, to have people absorb that message and understand that message.
Chief Judge Herring?
Well, I think people should be very involved in their communities, and they should be involved with families and children in their communities. So, obviously, having good schools so that kids have an option or belief or hope that they will have an opportunity to better their circumstances is really critical. To address some of the issues involving truancy is critical because it's a gateway to getting involved in the criminal justice system with that sort of increasing as you associate with others who are also truant or not law-abiding. I'm a parent. I think parents have to do their part. I think part of the problem is everybody's looking for somebody else to fix their problem is if they have no role in the matter. I think government obviously has a role in the matter. At the city level, where the mayor's office has established various programming and intervention and other efforts and initiatives aimed at suppressing guns and an addiction, I think those efforts need to continue. I think people need to engage with their city council people or members to make sure they're representing them in the way that the community believes is appropriate. And I think they need to keep up with and follow the system to see what public policy is. I also think people really need to understand what they're asking for, because if you have a mentality of just lock people up and throw away the key, when that happens, you do have mass incarceration. And then the argument is that, oh, my God, there's mass incarceration. So I think what people have to understand is that this is a very complicated problem. There are no quick fixes, but they have to get involved in their communities with people who represent them and who pass laws. They have to understand the court system and what the court's actual role is in the system. As we live in a democracy with an executive branch, a judicial branch, and a legislative branch, to see how all of those different entities work together, those are the things that I can recommend. But until the families and the communities are healed and people have opportunities to lead a better life and employment, you know, we're always going to be dealing with crime. And so we, you know, I don't think you want a system where we're locking everybody up. And so I think the only way to keep us from being reactionary in a situation like we've been experiencing with some bad actors because of their behavior is to really get to the root of the problem. And if people aren't educated, if they're not properly raised and don't have values and don't respect life, we're going to be in the situation that we're in.
Chief Judge Herring, do you believe that the problems that have been caused by COVID restrictions on the courts may in some way, shape, or form caused some of the problems that the mayor and the chief have been discussing?
Well, I mean, we have certainly not been able to have jury trials at the same rate that we would if we weren't subject to COVID restrictions. As you might recall, the city didn't really fully open until sometime in June. And then, as was the case today, other restrictions have to come back, even when you say the city is fully open. And that all depends on the positivity rate of the vaccine or the variant. And so we all have been in lockdown. Courts across the country have been in lockdown, so we have a backlog. Our court, unfortunately, also has 12 vacancies, meaning 12 judges are have moved on or retired, and those vacancies have existed for quite some time. And so as we attempt to dig out from having not been in a position until sometime earlier, I think in the spring, to start jury trials, we're going to need the judges who are there to try and dispose of those cases. You also should remember that most cases in the criminal justice system across the country and courts across the country don't even go to trial. It's 5 to 10% of the cases, certainly in the district, actually go to trial, according to a sentencing commission report from the D.C. Sentencing Commission in 2019. So obviously we have to get the cases scheduled so that we can bring people to trial. But the truth is, even if we lock people up for violent crime, if the city council decides because of issues like over-incarceration that we've locked too many people up and passed laws to have people released, we're going to have to follow those laws. And there could be a lot of merit, quite frankly, to something like that. I'm not taking a position, but I think to only point to one entity as being responsible for where we are is just not proper. And I do think that the gentleman who spoke earlier is very frustrated. I think there are lots of people who actually have to live in close proximity to crime are frustrated, and they are rightfully frustrated. But the court system can do its part, but the communities have to do their part. The government has to do its part, and all of us have to work together and not take shots at each other, because together we can make the system better.
To that point, and this is the thing that, and I'm not trying to play referee here. I most certainly don't want to put myself in that position, but I am trying to listen to what is being said in the public square. And that is something that you and Judge McKenna did today, which is rare. Usually, we only see the two of you behind your benches and in your robes. And this issue is important enough.
Yeah.
And obviously, you two care enough about this to come out from behind the benches to discuss this, not to defend yourselves, but to make a point. But with the mayor saying that this is not working, from your perspective, Judge McKenna, what do you think that you might be able to do within your purview to make change so that things can work? And forgive me, because I outside of a speeding ticket or two, I don't really know. that's the only time that I really want to see either one of you, if that. Let's be clear. But
we won't take it personally.
Yeah, truly. I don't want to see either one of you, although I do have a camera ticket I could talk about. But What power do you have to do to affect change that could that could make the man in chief say, okay, this is what we're talking about, and we can see that they are doing something?
Sure. So I just can't. I have to make the point that notwithstanding the pandemic, over the last 16 months, the criminal division has closed 7,500 cases. So we have been working these cases. We've been offering opportunities to individuals through diversion opportunities, plea agreements, and more recently through non-jury and jury trials to resolve their cases. We are looking forward to a full return to in-person operations in early September, just weeks away, where both detained and individuals on release will have the opportunity to come before the court, before the judges in the courtroom, in order to move their cases forward. So while I am proud and impressed with the work of the criminal division over the last 16 months, I am confident that in September, when we are back to resuming full in-person, closer to normal operations, that we will begin to see even more cases and move forward through the system.
I'll let you have the final word, Chief Judge Herring. I've got about 30 seconds for you.
Okay. We will continue working with our partners. I sit down with Chief Conte. I know the mayor and have worked with her on a number of things. I am not attacking her leadership. Obviously, the mayor, the court, Chief Conte, all of us are concerned about crime, and we need to continue to work together through the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, where we have the U.S. Attorney, the Office of Attorney General, and all of the participants that I just mentioned who are looking at crime statistics on a monthly basis, at least as a group of principals, to explore violence interruption efforts and prevention efforts and things like that. We will be going in the court into the community starting sometime in October. We're going to start in Ward 8 and move sort of in reverse order across the city to meet with individuals in different communities to talk about how we can help as a court to explain our role in the system and to tell the community about the services the court has. We will bring along with us individuals who can talk about the services that the city provides. But this is a tough thing, and we're doing our best.
Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring and Associate Judge Juliet McKenna of the D.C. Superior Court, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. And good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, July 29th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.